You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. This month, we go sea swimming with Brighton-based writers Josie Lloyd and Mark Radcliffe, and we speak to the author of this month's book club book, If They Knew, Sophie Flynn. I also give you a curated preview of literary events in this year's Brighton Fringe Festival, which runs through May. The book club is also available as a podcast, which you can download from wherever you get yours. Let's dive into the show. I am joined by Brighton-based Josie Lloyd, also known as Joanna Rees, to talk about her new book, Life Saving for Beginners. Josie, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's lovely to be back.
Can you tell us about this book, which I just finished this morning, and my heart is full of these gorgeous characters and their stories. I thought it was absolutely wonderful.
Oh, thank you. I'm so pleased you enjoyed it. Well, this book wasn't really intended, to be honest. What happened was I wrote the Cancer Ladies Running Club, which was all about, based on my experience of going through breast cancer. And that had been really good fun. And I decided to write a book called Love in the Death Cafe, because during my recovery I went to a death cafe where people go and they discuss death, and people and all sorts of people went, and it was the most fascinating thing. And there was, and I thought, well, this is a great group of people for a romance, and I'm always kind of a bit of a magpie and sort of stealing people's stories. In fact, there is a sign in my kitchen that says careful or you'll end up in my novel, which is very true. Anyway, so I was writing a book called Love in the Death Cafe about how we never talk about death and how we should talk about death and how we should all have a good death. And then COVID struck. And I was like, oh, we weren't talking about death, but now all we can talk about is death. And it was really discombobulating, because I said to my agent, well, I don't know what to do, because, you know, at that point, we didn't know how it was going to, whether it was Armageddon, whether we were going to come out of it, how we would feel after it. And so writing a contemporary novel, you just scuppered, because I was thinking, well, I can't write this book when something so monumental has happened to us as a society. It's never going to fly. So I downed tools and I went back to the beginning, which is what you should always do, I feel, as a author, and write what you know. And at that time, I'd sort of started sea swimming in the summer, and then I just sort of carried on. And then when COVID struck, I mean, the sea became a complete lifeline for me, because I live in Brighton. And I'm 5 minutes walk down to the beach, and it was just the only way we could kind of communicate and see each other and have any sense of normality during lockdown, is to go in the sea. And it became this, I became quite obsessed with this lovely thing, not just of the cold water, which I realized was a massive benefit, but of this incredible camaraderie that I met with these people and these women. And we all kind of really supported each other, and it was wonderful. So I thought, well, I will write a book about the sea. And also because of COVID and because we live in downtown central Brighton, I saw a lot of homelessness, and I was very moved by it, and also very upset by it in equal measures, and kind of did quite a lot of research into the homelessness. And I realized how really difficult it is, if something drops off radar, how to find somewhere. So I thought, these, it's sort of like a magnet with iron filings, these kind of ideas came to me, and this book just sort of came up, and the characters kind of really honestly walked onto the page themselves. They're not really based on anybody that I know, but they kind of embody the communal spirit that we all kind of felt. So I wanted to take lots of different women who all had a different scenario, that were going to be cured by the sea, and that their relationship with the sea and with swimming and going into cold water would change their life. But the central story was Maddie. And actually, I used the circumstances of lockdown to be able to make the story, because she came to Brighton and she would have stayed in a hotel or with friends, but it was lockdown. So she had to stay in a little apartment by herself, which isolated her, which meant that she needed to get some community, which meant that she went to the beach. So all of these decisions came because of the circumstances of lockdown. But I also didn't want to make it COVID heavy, because I knew that it would hopefully come out after COVID. So the sea became, it was a way to write a book about what we were going through without writing a book about what we were going through. That's a very long answer, but that is the answer.
So you talked a bit about homelessness, Josie, and there are lots of kind of themes in this book, as there often is with contemporary fiction. So we've got drugs, menopause, infidelity, body image, sexuality, aging, lost love, etc. How did you kind of research these things that might not have, you know, come from your own experiences?
Well, oddly enough, one of the women that I swim with, Tara, is in charge of sort of like the homeless situation at the council. So she gave me an enormous amount of intel about the whole issue of homelessness and rooflessness, and about how it's dealt with from a policy point of view, and also what happens to people. And she sort of told me some in confidence, some of her case loads, not mentioning any names, but she told me the kind of issues that she deals with and the kind of things that were going on. I talked to the local police, the PCSO, who is dealing with all the kind of drugs in our area. And I talked to Knight, who were the people down at the seafront who were handing out, amazing people. What an incredible charity. People who were just handing out much needed food and supplies to people who would just come to the seafront. And so I got involved in that. And, you know, I talked to a few people who had been homeless and who had, you know, who have had been like recovering alcoholics and drug addicts. And I mean, I realize it's very, you know, we were only ever a few bad decisions or a bad bits of luck from being homeless ourselves. You know, it's not, it's, it seems like them and us, and you know, it feels very much to them like them and us, but actually they're just part of our society, and it's our society that is causing these homeless issues, especially with rents going up. And what you see is people kind of plop out of the bottom of the system. You know, and quite a lot of people who are homeless are still holding down jobs. They're still working. They're still making ends meet. They're doing their best, but they've lost their home for whatever reason, or their rent's been put up, or they've had some terrible split up with their partner and they just got nowhere to go. And it's kind of very clear that to me that actually at the base of it all, having a very strong tie with your family is so important. You know, having... if you have terrible family arguments, which is what has happened to Maddie, and if your family breaks apart and there is a rift in your family, it is, that is kind of a real kind of catalyst for a lot of problems happening. And, you know, it seems to me that, you know, people really need to learn how to be kind and to look after each other and nurture, realize how strong and how important those bonds are.
Absolutely.
And actually, it's quite interesting. I mean, there's been quite a lot of research recently, and I don't know that Jon Snow's got a program on the telly, but they did some research into blue zones around the world, which are places where people live very happily and healthily into their hundreds. And there's places in Japan, and there's places in South America and Antarctica. You know, it's all over the place. It's not to do with climate or food, they discovered. What it was to do with was walking and connectedness. So if people who, as they get older, have a connection in their family and they're looked after by their family and they have a place in their society as a family, you know, as a, they have a way of doing stuff, then that's what makes longevity happen, healthy longevity. So yes, it's very interesting. So I'm interested in all of that. So yes, that's what's, am I answering your question?
You absolutely are. You always do. I get a bit lost in your answers. So you've got this gorgeous cast of characters in Life Saving for Beginners. We've got Maddie, as you said, Helga, Tor, Dominica and Claire. I'd love it if you could kind of give us a bit of a brief about all of them and how their stories developed for you.
Okay, well, I started with Maddie. So Maddie, I wanted to have as somebody who'd got the perfect life, but she got the perfect life on Instagram, basically. So she's taken a plot of land, she's raised a horrible building that was there, and she's built this house from scratch, and she's documented every single step of it on her Instagram channel. And it's become this massive rod for her back that she has to present this perfect life. So we meet on Christmas Day, and she's made this grotto in the garden, and she's laid up this table as if she's got millions of guests coming. But the truth is, she's having a microwave meal in the kitchen with her husband, who she doesn't really get on with, and their son is missing, and they don't have loads of friends around, and it's all for show. So I wanted to take her on a journey from that to becoming real and to embracing what was real and to get back to herself. So we always start with kind of characters, and you want to take them on a journey from A to B. So she is somebody who goes on the biggest journey, and that was sort of like the hook for the that I hung everybody else on. So Dominica has been recently bereaved. Her husband was her partner was a paramedic, and he died of COVID. So she's very raw and quite angry and upset, and her life has really capsized because she's grieving. You know, we meet her and she's really in grief, and it's sad, and she's lost her partner and she doesn't really know how to carry on. And she's been a Samaritan before. She's been a volunteer at the Samaritans, and she's part of her journey is that she goes back to the Samaritans and she starts to be able to live again. And the women in the group give her the confidence to just move forward. And I think what I really like exploring in contemporary fiction is the little changes that you can document with some characters, which are really powerful. It doesn't, you don't have to have a massive journey from kind of like single to married with bells on, you know, sometimes it's just the incremental changes that you see a character go through that are really powerful. So that was her. Then I have got Helga. Now Helga was loosely based on Sandy, who is a mate of mine in Brighton, who had a dog called Nala, who she used to swim with every day. Now, Nala was quite a special dog. She was like, that's what's inspired me to get my dog as a therapy pet. But Nala used to go to hospitals and see all the children, and was, you know, was made into immortal by Julia Donaldson in her book about the hospital dog. And Sandy swims all the time. So she's absolutely bonkers. She's in her 70s, and come hell or high water, she's in. So she's quite an inspiration. So I quite like taking Helga as a character, as somebody who was older, because I realized in my experience of swimming on the beach that I have friends who are in their 20s and friends who are all the way up to friends in their 70s, and there's a whole massive range of us. And what's been joyous is to meet women of different ages and to be actually friends with them. Like my friend Frances is turning 17 this year, but she is, you know, there was no age difference between us. I mean, we went to a party on Tuesday and there was 2 20-somethings, 1 30-something, 3 40-somethings, 2 50-somethings, 3 60-somethings. We're lovely. How lovely to just have this way. And I love the wisdom of older people. So I wanted to make her quite wise, but also somebody who was starting to feel a little fearful that she's had this really wonderful life. She's been a solo sailor, but she's missed some opportunities, and she's getting to the point in her life where she's frightened. She's frightened for her future, and her niece wants her to go back to where she's from in Scandinavia and to settle down and be in a home. And she doesn't want to be old. So actually, what was wonderful was giving her a romance and reconnecting her with a lost love, which was actually joyous to write. Because I didn't, you know, you don't want all the men to be baddies in these books. And then we've got Tor, who is a charity worker, and she is struggling to reveal her sexuality to her parents and feels very judged by other people, mostly by herself, and she needs to learn to love herself. And that's her journey that she goes on with her gang. And then Claire, who's hit the menopause and is invisible. She's just invisible. She's a mum. She's got a work at home husband who's really stressed. And I think we all went through this in menopause. We went through this in COVID. Quite a lot of people were suddenly living at home with their partners, one of whom was really stressed the whole time. And you had to creep around the kitchen because they're on a Zoom call the whole time. So I gave her that sort of scenario. And she's got two boys who kind of are moving away from her. And they're becoming more adolescent. And she's hitting the menopause and she's isolated and she's really stuck in her life and invisible. And through sea swimming, she learns to be seen and she rediscovers her mojo. And that's really wonderful. And she learns to love herself, you know, in a really fundamental way, because being on the beach and being in a group of sea swimmers, nobody gives a flying monkeys what anybody looks like. Nobody cares about your body shape or your body type, or, you know, everyone looks beautiful in the sea, you know, whooping with a group of people like who are acting like 3-year-olds is just a joyous, wonderful thing. So, you know, nobody cares. So, and I think that's very liberating. So I wanted to show that.
Can you read us some, please, Jo?
I shall. Yes. Okay. So, Okay, so I'm going to read a little bit from the beginning of the book, and this is Dominica. They make an odd tribe, Dominica thinks, feeling a surge of affection for these unlikely friends. Oh, by the way, they're on the beach and it's Christmas Day, and they're going in for Christmas Day, sorry. They make an odd tribe, Dominica thinks, feeling a surge of affection for these unlikely friends. There are other swimming gangs she could have joined, but the women from her old yoga class swim regularly, but Dominica wanted to swim without their concerned expressions. She happened to arrive at the beach at the same time as Helga and Tor a few times, and before she knew it, they'd formed a floquette of their own. In a couple of strides, Helga surrendering gracefully to the water, bending her knees, her shoulders sinking. She sighs as if the sea is a lover welcoming her with a caress. She flips onto her back, her face radiant. She might be the other side of 70, but in the water, Helga looks about 7. Her feet pop up as she floats, her arms out to her sides like a quirky otter. Dominica sees her focusing on the bandstand and knows she's working out which way the current is running from the pull on of her body in the water. She's a stickler for water safety. Dominica walks forward with Tor, concentrating on making sure she doesn't hold her breath, but it's a shock nevertheless, bringing her fuzzy brain into focus like a camera lens. The beach, the land, every thought she's had just up until moments ago is in the past. There's only now. She's tried meditation, but this works much better for calming her scrambled thoughts. A plunge in the sea pushes her mental reset button like nothing else. She knows that the trick is to get her hands in, so she walks in deeper, her fingertips under the surface, her gloves filling with cold water. She's aware now of the sound of the sea and the sucking shush of the backwash. The water, which had seemed clear green from the shore, is tea-coloured up close. A wall of milky builder's brew is coming closer now, rearing up in her vision, and she stands firm, letting the waves sweep her up in its path, lifting her off her feet. And she's in. She sighs out through her mouth like a woman in labour, going through her natural reaction to gasp as the cold hits her spine. She can see the black shadows of her gloves as she breaststrokes out towards the glittering horizon. The waves are bouncy and the exposed bit of neck at the base of her hairline tingles like a high-top drum. She's aware of her skin, the whole of it, stinging. Chris, oh, Chris, how you'd love this, she thinks, noticing the tears rising, but she's resigned to them. On land, she feels that she's a vessel full of unshed tears that might spring a leak at any time and buckle. But here, where the water inside collides with the water outside, she feels more solid than she has done for days. She carefully puts her face under the surface, not wanting to get her bobble hat or her hair wet. She likes the feeling of the violent, masochistic brain freeze, and she takes the opportunity to open her mouth and scream as loudly as she can, knowing that only the sea will know the secret and the others won't hear. She comes up, the salt taste of the water filling her mouth and nose, the cold seeping into her bloodstream, like the delicious relief of a drug.
Oh, it's such tantalising imagery about the sea, Jo. You can really tell that you are a lover of the sea and of swimming in it. So you are a writer in Brighton and live and work here. Can you imagine doing this job and writing these books anywhere else?
I mean, yeah, I can. I mean, yes. I mean, my Barbara Cartland fantasy in my grand mansion in the country on a chaise longue with a dictation, somebody doing a dictation. Yeah, I can imagine that. I like writing abroad as well. I've got a house in Mallorca and I like writing there, although it's damned hot. I do like writing here. And I, although I have to say, I've just sort of started my 21st novel. And I did sort of start it thinking, God, I really should have painted the study before I started another book. It's kind of, I do feel creatively now that I would quite like a new space. But it was wonderful writing this book in lockdown and being able to, you know, really use all the swims that we actually did physically as research for the book. I do love writing and I love Brighton. I mean, it's a wonderful, creative, fabulous place. But I do have slightly itchy feet at the moment. I think it's because I'm in a kind of weird life stage because two of my daughters have left home. So one has gone to university, the middle one, and the elder one was home from university, but she's now moved back down to Bristol. And we have the little one who's doing her GCSEs. But this kind of vast vista has opened up of, Oh my God, our children have gone, will have left home, which is kind of a kind of mourning process for us both, me and my husband. But also it's kind of like, wow, we could go live in South America. What are we going to do? So, yeah, so we're slightly, so I'm slightly in a kind of, I've plopped into a slightly new phase of life, which is sort of unexpected. But anyway, yeah.
And will we see any of that in your next book? Is there anything you can tell us?
Well, I'm actually writing a cozy crime next. I thought I'd try my hand at it because it seems to be a very popular genre. It's difficult to pitch the kind of women's fiction that I do, because it's increasingly difficult as an author, unless you are absolutely completely clear what it is, exactly what it is, and you can say to the bookseller, it is an orange, put it with the oranges. It's quite difficult to get books noticed, seen, heard, stocked into the supermarkets. So I thought actually what I'd do is try my skill at a bit of a cozy crime. So I'm doing that, which is a totally different writing experience for me, because quite often I start these books with an idea and a hook, and it builds up from there, and I kind of write and I kind of work out the plot roughly, but as I go along. But with this, you have to have so much of the plot completely sorted out. So I went through this unbearable planning stage, which was like pulling teeth trying to get the plot sorted out, and I chucked it out several times, and it's been quite a process. But now I've got a really watertight plot and a very big I've got a 20,000 word plot document, so I'm doing a wonderful thing. I'm just sort of writing it down because it's all planned, and I've never done that before. After 25 years of writing, you would have thought that I would have learnt the lesson that they write in chapter one of every how to write a novel book, which is plan it. Never have, really. So anyway, so there we are. So it's quite fun. I like a new challenge. So yeah, so I'm doing that. So that's out in May next year, May 2024. And but then in the meantime, I'm on tenterhooks because the film of the Cancer Ladies Running Club, which I've called the Bright Side Running Club because that's what it was called in the States, is really gaining traction, and it's out with some really good actors. And we've got a really good director and a producer, and we've got some financiers. So it's all kind of coming together. So I'm kind of in that stupidly hopeful phase that something brilliant's going to happen any second. So yeah.
Thank you so much, Josie, for joining us. How can we find and follow you and get our hands on a copy of your fabulous books?
Oh, well, Life Saving for Beginners is out now in bookshops. It's in Brighton, actually. There's some really lovely support in City Books and in Waterstones, so you'll find it there. It is, if you follow me on Instagram, I have to make a confession here, not terribly good at social media. I was an early adopter, and I've totally fallen out of love with it, and I'd rather spend my time writing. So I'm not terribly great on social media, but I do go it on occasionally. So you're best off finding me, Josie Lloyd, on Instagram. I'm Josie Lloyd Writer, I think, on Instagram. Josie Lloyd Books on Twitter, and Josie Lloyd just on Facebook. So just, and I've got a Facebook page. So that's the way to find me. And all down the beach in my swimming costume with my dog.
Your dry rope.
Yeah.
Mark Radcliffe is the author of two novels, Gabriel's Angel, which was published in 2010, and Stranger Than Kindness, which was published in 2013, both published by Blue Moose. He is also the author of a collection of short stories called Superpowers, which was published by the Valley Press. His new book, Three Gifts, is out now with Epoch Press. Mark, tell us about this wonderful book and welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you very much. Hello. Thank you. Okay. So Three Gifts is about a young man who barely makes it onto the planet. Difficult birth, difficult family, born into poverty. So it's a comedy. And he struggles a little bit. He loses his father. He's looked after by his mother. And his mother gets cancer at around the same time as he discovers sea swimming as a 12-year-old. And he's offered a deal by a strange swimmer, which is essentially, if you give me 20 years of your life, your mother's cancer will go away. So he experiences it as a gift. It's an exchange, but it changes his life. And he revisits that throughout the rest of his life. So it's a broadly magical, set by the sea story about gratitude and generosity, I think.
So before we dig deeper into Three Gifts, I'd love to ask you about your previous books. Can you tell us about Gabriel's Angel and Stranger Than Kindness?
Okay, so there's something probably a little bit otherly about all of them. Gabriel's Angel is essentially, it's about a sports journalist who's just about to undergo IVF with his partner. And on the way to that appointment, he gets run over by a car and ends up in a coma. And whilst he's in the coma, he finds himself in a therapeutic group just beneath heaven, which is facilitated by angels. And if he does well in the therapy, he's allowed to pass through therapy and return to Earth and finish his IVF and get on with his life. And if he does really badly, then he goes to hell, or worse, he has to stay in therapy. So that's Gabriel's Angel. Stranger Than Kindness is based very much in a hospital. It was around madness, really, and working alongside madness. And it's based on essentially, it comes up with a theory that somebody who has a mental health problem discovers that if they make tea with freshly drawn dew from a green lawn, then they begin to recover. And set this within a context of psychiatry and psychology, which prefers to have a slightly more controlling approach. I suppose it's about redemption and hope and small ideas, really. I poured a lot of psychiatric stuff into it because I used to be a nurse.
And superpowers. I'd love to hear about this collection, and I'd love for you to speak a bit about the difference between writing longer form work and short stories.
Okay. Well, the collection essentially was a response to something that happened to me. I lost my mother, and she, by coincidence, she raised me on her own. And I found myself becoming really fascinated by people who I believe to be remarkable, but were hidden to the world, just the hidden strengths that were often held by women, often hold the rest of us up, and had no place in popular narrative. So Superpowers was a collection of strange superpowers: the capacity to talk to a cat, the ability to bring dead spiders back to Earth, the ability to appear invisible simply by being quite dull, those sorts of superpowers. I experienced it as a flight of imagination, and there was less about holding a world, I think, and more about visiting people. I remember somebody once described to me the difference between a novel and a short story is a novel is a marriage and a short story is being kissed by a stranger in the dark. And I quite like the idea, I'm not sure too sure about the dark, but I quite like the idea of it just being a visitation of imagination that you can pause with and stay with briefly and then leave, hoping that the impression you left is a warm one or a useful one or a good one. Does that make sense?
That's lovely. That's really nice. So moving back to Three Gifts, your latest book, where did this idea come from? And I'd really love for you to talk a bit about the way that you depict masculinity in your writing and the role of men.
Okay. Thank you. Probably two things to say about that. I think intellectually where it came from was I sat with my best friend who had cancer for the last period of his life when he knew he was dying, and we would meet and sit together and reflect. And he reflected on many things which I thought lent some wisdom to the world and lent some understanding to the world. He reveled in simple beauty. He reveled in love. He reveled in all the sort of things that are easy to dismiss from a distance, but when you're close to your own mortality, I think are heightened. And one of the things that he and I talked a lot about, as we were drawn together, I think, as working class men of a particular type who found themselves in caring professions. So we didn't quite fit into any group, but we were very wedded with our own working class backgrounds. And he talked a lot about responsibility. And I think there's a tradition. I think I'm going to say something deeply controversial here, because I'm going to sound like I'm criticizing Bruce Springsteen. There's a tradition of masculinity that sees responsibility as a burden eternally. It's sort of rooted in that John Updike stuff about, we all need to be free. And you know, Springsteen, who I adore, Hungry Heart, got a wife and kids, in Baltimore Jack. I went out for a ride and I never came back. And everyone's kind of going, yeah, Bruce, on you go. And there's a little sense that responsibility is this thing to be escaped from. And I was quite interested talking to my friend about how much responsibility was an expression of love. That sacrifice or the generosity or simply leaning towards somebody and giving help and being responsible and holding was love. So responsibility is essentially, in terms of masculinity, a gift rather than this burden to be escaped from, that rather overly trodden trope. So intellectually, I was interested in that. And it manifested a little bit. I used to work in a hospice, and there was an elderly gentleman who I worked with for some time who was in excruciating pain. And he talked a lot and quietly in a very noble way about when do I stop the treatment that is making this hurt? When can I just let go? And he also talked a lot about his wife who died 5 years earlier. And he would say he was lucky because she hadn't suffered. And he would cry whenever he talked about it. This was an old man who loved his old wife in an old fashioned way and had loved her for 60 years. And he was from the generation of the war. And I'll always remember that he said he started his national service 3 days after the armistice. So he considered himself lucky. He did 3 years in the army, but people had stopped killing people. And all the other kids from his town, they'd gone when there was dying going on. So he was ingrained with this sense of good fortune. He was lucky. He'd seen his children. He'd met his grandchildren. And now here he was, 90, and he was in agony. And he bore this pain with a real nobility. And he said to me once, I used to pray to my God that my wife didn't feel the pain. Give it to me. Let her die in peace. And there he was feeling the pain. It was as if he'd written a contract. He had made his exchange. So the answer to his own question of how long do I have to do this was until I've paid for my wife not being in pain, which is obviously, it's a ridiculous idea. To think it is ridiculous, but we all feel it. Every human being at some point will feel, how can I help? What can I do in the face of powerlessness? And I was really interested by those feelings. So it all congregated around that. And I'm conscious now that I may be talking too much, but it all congregated around that.
There's a really big part of your book, and I guess a character in itself, is the sea and sea swimming. And I know that you are a really keen sea swimmer, and that is something that we've already spoken a lot about on this month's episode of the podcast. And I'd really love you to speak a bit to sea swimming and your relationship with it and how you decided to bring it into Three Gifts.
Okay. I needed to bring it in because I needed something to gather around. It is a significant character. I've swum for a really long time. And I've swum in winter for a really long time. In fact, I've swum for so long, I don't know why they call it wild swimming. It's just swimming. That's just what we do. But it's played a really significant broad part in the way I've managed to become older. And I've built a community around it. And it's a community that seems to me to bring out the best in people. And there's something magical about the sea that does that. It holds you. It reminds you to be afraid. It reminds you of your smallness. It reminds you that you're alone, because even if you swim with 50 people, you're swimming absolutely on your own. It changes your body when it's cold. It changes your body when you are strong. It shows you when you're weak. It's a mirror in all ways. So it felt to me important that this child, as it was, who was desperately looking for something that might look like salvation, that might look like help, because he was a very lonely, isolated child. It came from the sea, and it was manifested by a strange, decent man, seemingly to him, because up till then he hadn't actually met any decent men, because his father had left him and his grandfather had broken and he was alone. This decent man just came and was able to swim. So he looked strong and he looked able and he was generous. So there's something about symbolizing, I think, the generosity of the sea, the power of it. And I don't know, I suppose talking about the sea, if you think about it, is basically saying we're on the edge of something. And this person lives their life on the edge of something. And the sea is the perfect example of that.
Can you read us some, please, Mark?
I will, but I'm not going to read about the sea, if that's okay.
That's fine.
Okay, this is chapter 2. When Francis was born, the doctor told his mother that he was very ill and that she should prepare herself for the worst. His mother was an anxious, perennially lonely woman named Rose, who had wanted a child more than she believed any woman had wanted one before, and she did not know how you were supposed to prepare yourself for the loss of your baby. She thought the doctor must have been mistaken with his advice, and she immediately wanted to ask for a second opinion, for someone else to take a look at her constantly screaming newborn. It was the 1970s, though, and demanding that cleverer doctors be called upon was not an option for her. Praying was, and so was saying things like, "He will not die. God would not give him to me only to take him away again. God is not cruel." Rose was considered quite old for a mother, being 3 months away from her 38th birthday, and deep down she still believed herself to be a virgin. She was a short, slightly plump woman with grey darting eyes, and the accumulated sense of always feeling like the odd one out had drawn fear onto her face. And it was that fear which people saw first when they looked at her. She'd been put into foster care by her widowed mother at the age of 6, only to be retrieved by her stepfather and a baby sister called Ruby when she was 11. She did a lot of childcare by way of thanks and worked hard at being useful, but she never quite banished the belief that she would be disposable again if the house ever felt too small. It was a feeling she vowed never to pass on to her own child, should she ever manage to have one. Francis's father, Percy, was a big, recurrently absent man who liked to drink and had, in his youth, been considered moderately clever and passably handsome. He retained the slightly inflated confidence that those quite limited gifts had bestowed. He was something of a faded womanizer, 17 years older than Rose, with thin red veins showing through his cheeks and exhausted damp eyes. He almost verified Rose's claims of innocence by openly doubting that he was the baby's father. "Are you sure it's mine? Because believe me, that wasn't sex," he'd said the day she told him she was pregnant, and she burst into tears and screamed, "I've never been touched by another man. How could you even say that?" Percy was unconvinced. There'd been touching, yes, and something akin to intimacy, but his third-hand Ford Prefect 100E was a small car with unmovable seats, and he had a bad back. He'd offered to drive Rose home at closing time, even though it was out of his way, and he'd taken the scenic route along the coast road where he'd stopped near enough to the sea to hear the waves and the wind, and then he put his large cigarette-stained hand on her knee. "I'm sorry, I don't know what to do," Rose had whispered, longing for knowing not to matter. "Just do what comes naturally," Percy had replied, working hard not to sigh. "None of this comes naturally," thought Rose, along with, "Why do you still have your coat on? Where did I put my other glove?" She went straight to bed when she got home, and when she got undressed, she noticed her tights were ripped, so she hid them at the bottom of the chest of drawers so she wouldn't see them in the morning. "We didn't actually do it, Ruby. Not properly. Not really," Rose told her disapproving sister a few weeks later after finding out she was pregnant. "You have to marry him," said her sister, a respectable woman, married to a bank clerk who aspired to home ownership and feared that any association with a fallen woman could affect her husband's career prospects. "He hasn't asked me." But Rose's path to maternity ward didn't matter remotely after the doctor had delivered his verdict. "It's got the wrong sort of blood," he'd said, or at least that's what she heard. "Change it," Rose had told him, but he shook his head. "If only it were that easy." Is that okay?
That's so lovely. This is such a gorgeous book, Mark. Congratulations. I absolutely loved reading it. There's something really kind of parable-esque about your writing. Where do you think that comes from for you as a writer?
I don't know. I'm interested in otherness, I think. And it might be, I don't like psychological pain. I think I work too much in psychiatry. So I like redemption and I like people coming back from dark places. So I think that's what parables do. I think they give us a circle of meaning that leads us somewhere that is less painful. So, and there's something fairy story about that as well, isn't there? Fairy stories do the same thing. So I think there's something about that. It's a failing on my part, so I turn it into an activity.
So you teach creative writing, Mark. You teach creative writing and publishing at Weston College out in Chichester. Can you talk a bit about this work and how you balance yourself as a writer and as a tutor?
Okay, I balance myself really badly. So I'll come to that second. But how I see the work is a joy. I think if you get a group of writers to work with, then you become an accompanist rather than a teacher. And I think that that's what we're trying to do here. That's very much the way I see it, that I develop a relationship with the books that the people are writing. So I think I get on well with my students, but I get on even better with their books. So I can, after a couple of years, say, you know, that character, I was thinking about that character, so-and-so. What happened for that to happen? So you have some really interesting discussions, but in so doing, you're entering all these novels and worlds I don't write at the same time. So I have 6 months of really intense teaching where I do some notes, but otherwise I'm just working. And then I reward myself by going off to a Greek island and walking up a hill and sitting there for a month and just writing, because the two acts seem to me to be separate. I need some kind of separation from other people's activities in order to be productive, I think. But the teaching's a joy.
And what are the most common mistakes you see from writers that you work with that anyone listening who might be interested in writing can take advice from?
Okay, two things. The one, people always talk about show, not tell. That's too obvious. I would say exposition. People find themselves writing scenes where they think it's important that everyone knows everything here. And so it becomes overly exposed and overly written. And it's a little bit like the camera moving away from the drama and beginning to shift around the room. So not only is it disorientating for a reader, it stops the good work that people are doing by creating tension. So there's something definitely about that. I also would suggest, and this is slightly harder and more controversial, that one of the problems people have is when they come up to a nub of something where it's really important, they've constructed it, it might be from their own world in some way, psychologically significant. Sometimes they lose their nerve, and sometimes, and I think we've all done it, sometimes they move to the peripheral and they call it metaphor, or they call it symbolism, or they call it creative writing. But really they're taking their eye away from what's really important here. And what's really important is tends to be in front of you, tends to have stayed with it. And it's really important for writers to stay with it, to not leave that scene until it's absolutely bled in all of the meaningful ways. I think people do that too often. That would be my two things, I think.
Excellent, excellent. And what's the best writing advice you've ever been given?
Oh, Bernice Rubens said, always write in yesterday's blood. And I think that's really good advice. People, it's important that we use our embodied emotional world to inform what we're doing, because otherwise we're just writing words. Unless it's got lifeblood and feeling and heart, it doesn't mean anything. But if it's got rage, or if it's got rawness, or if it's got something that hasn't yet cultivated itself through the body, it's like listening to a drunk tell you philosophy. It's loud and always wrong.
Thank you so much, Mark, for joining us on the Brighton Book Club. How can we find and follow you and get our hands on a copy of your books?
I'm Mark A. Radcliffe with a big A on Twitter. I've only just started that, so I have like two followers. But look at me being down with the kids. It's launched on March the 2nd, so it'll be in all good bookshops after that. All good bookshops after that. Come to Waterstones. Come to any of the independent bookshops and buy it, please.
Our book club book this month is Sophie Flynn's If They Knew, an absolutely unputdownable thriller, which doesn't tap into kind of a lot of the usual thriller tropes. I found it really exciting and really original to read. It's as much about marriage and moral dilemmas as it is a kind of thrilling page-turning read. It also takes us on this really interesting journey in time and space, because we go back in time to New York with one of the main characters living there, being in college there, and then we have a kind of very sleepy Oxfordshire village in the present, and I absolutely love the contrast between them. I am really excited to be joined by the author Sophie Flynn to talk more about If They Knew. Sophie, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Hello, very nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
This is your third book. It follows on from All My Lies and Keep Them Close. Can you give us your little elevator pitch for your first two books?
Oh, God. I hate it people ask me that because they're gone out of my mind. So my first one, All My Lies, is about what happens when a woman in an unhappy marriage has her first love come back with the promise to escape, and what happens after that kind of goes a little bit wrong. And Keep Them Close is a mother of twins who has spent a lot of time talking to strangers on the internet on a forum like Mumsnap. And a stranger from that site comes into her real life, kind of trying to spill all her secrets and ruin her life.
And If They Knew, your latest book.
Yeah, so If They Knew is about a infertile couple who've kind of been through IVF and various challenges on their way to have a family. We meet them just as they are about to bring home a little girl called Isabel through adoption. So they have 2 weeks before she comes home. But just as that happens, a celebrity turns up dead at a private members club near their village in Oxfordshire.
I really loved how high the stakes were in this book. And I thought all the stuff with adoption and IVF and infertility was really, really beautifully written. That must have been quite a lot of research for the adoption process, because it's very much not straightforward.
No, it's not. And it's interesting because everyone kind of thinks they know about adoption and how it works. But there's so much paperwork and different processes that go into it, and really kind of strict guidelines on who's able to adopt and the kind of things that might stop that process. So I thought it was quite an interesting kind of aspect to do, because like you say, the stakes are so high. And when you're in that situation, you kind of worry about every single little thing you've ever done, let alone kind of the big things like there are in the book.
Absolutely. I've heard you say in interviews that this is your most personal book. I know that you also spent some time living in the States. Can you talk a bit about the process of kind of fictionalizing parts of your life?
Yeah, I mean, this definitely, I have to say to people who know me, like, it is, they'll recognize all the parts based on mine and my husband's life. It's definitely fictional. So yeah, I went to uni in New York when I was younger, also to be a musician, like Hannah, my main character, does. She kind of falls in love and has this very dramatic time in New York. I did not fall in love, which my husband would be pleased to know, because we were together back then. But kind of a lot of those things about New York that were probably not, again, like typical of what people imagine going to New York and studying. It's kind of, it sounds like the dream, and it was a great time, but obviously, like all situations, there's kind of darker sides to it, and things that aren't necessarily that enjoyable. So I've always wanted to write about that time in my life, because it was really interesting and brought me into contact with really interesting people. I went to Sarah Lawrence College, which is kind of known for having the sons and daughters of various famous people. So very, very different to my life back home. So I thought that was quite interesting. And then me and my husband have gone through and are still going through infertility. And I wanted to write about that, really, because, like, again, it's such a strange process to be in, and it's so particular to the way you feel and think. And like there is a scene in the book, and it's one of the things that I remember when we first started kind of the infertility journey, and you have these forms and they ask you, like, have you ever committed a crime? And I thought, oh, well, I haven't. But suddenly your lives are like completely under the microscope with infertility, in a way that, like, if you're lucky enough to just have children naturally, you don't have to go through any of those processes, and you're just kind of bestowed a child without someone deciding whether you're worthy of one.
So can you read, please, from If They Knew?
I will, yeah. So this is the very first chapter of the book, and it's from Hannah's perspective. All of the couples in the waiting room look just like us, scared, shell-shocked, hopeful. The man opposite us jigs his foot relentlessly, one leg folded at the knee, taking up all the space between him and his wife. She is dwarfed in comparison, her body so curled in on itself, it's amazing she takes up any room at all. Her eyes flip between the clock and his foot, as if it's his obsessive movement that's powering the tick of his hands. Charlie squeezes my hand and I sit back in my seat. His legs are pressed together at the knee, straight, solid, still. His feet don't tap, his eyes don't roam the room. He simply stares at the door, waiting for it to open, waiting for our names to be called. It's not that this day doesn't mean as much to Charlie as it does to all the other nervous couples in here. It probably means more. This is just the way my husband is. Unflappable, as Mum often calls him, pulled in a crisis. And that's been helpful these last few years, when we have raced from one crisis to another. And I have simply let myself be blown away with it all, while he stands stock still, blocking as much of the impact from me as he can. Sometimes I've wished he would show some more emotion. I've screamed at him more than a few times. They've learned to recognise the signs of feeling in and now that have nothing to do with crying or screaming or falling apart. Where I flail around in our losses, Charlie goes stiff. Right now, he is more rigid than ever. Charlie and Hannah Wilson. The smiling receptionist appears from behind the door and calls us through. We've been here often enough for her to welcome us like old friends, and I feel the eyes of the other couples boring into our backs. There will be all sorts here. Couples on their first appointment, slightly misty-eyed about it all still, through to couples who've already got their little miracle safe at home and are simply here for a check-in. It's strange to think that Charlie and I are right in the middle, the doe-eyed magic of it all long lost in a mountain of paperwork, but not yet secure enough to be strolling through this door completely happily. I cross my fingers and shove them in my pocket, embarrassed at my own childish rituals still with me after all these years. Take a seat. Andrea will be with you in just a moment. Can I get you anything to drink? Tea, coffee, water? It's been a few weeks since we've been here and I've forgotten the rapid pace at which the receptionist speaks. I rack my brain for her name as Charlie replies. No thanks, Emily. We're fine. He smiles. Of course Charlie remembers her name. Charlie remembers everything. She exits and leaves us in silence, both too nervous to speak or even acknowledge each other. Within a few moments, Andrea walks in and I feel Charlie grow even stiffer beside me. This woman holds our hope in her hands.
Your writing is so beautiful, and that's not something you often find in thrillers. So I'd really like to know a bit more about how you feel about the genre, because, you know, you write in the thriller genre, but your books don't always feel like straightforward thrillers.
I think this one definitely was the one where, in terms of reviews, got the most mixed reviews, because some people who were expecting like a very straight thriller felt like it was more like women's fiction. And then people expecting women's fiction were like, oh, it's a bit gory. So I absolutely love thrillers. I read all the thrillers. And I do read some women's fiction. I don't read a lot of literary fiction. And that's kind of my main thing, is just thrillers. Because I do think some of them, there's loads out there which are really beautifully written and kind of like real like heart. And I think that's what I really like about stories, is like, I'm not massively interested in like who killed who or things like that, or how anyone got killed. It's just like, why would someone ever find themselves in that situation? And that's something I'm not very good at, is working out. I know someone's got to get killed at some point, and I'm always like, how can they just fall? I love to make people fall.
That actually really leads me nicely onto my next question. How do you keep the kind of crime and forensic details accurate? Because people who love thrillers are real sticklers for this.
They are. And I did used to work in a police press office, which was helpful, because we used to read all the crime notes. That was my favourite part of the job, was you kind of get the actual scenes of the stuff from the police officers and read it in detail of what happened, which is also why I never feel that things are too overdramatic. Because, I mean, I worked in Warwickshire Police and West Mercia Police, which is quite rural. And they're not kind of these big inner city places, but we have murders and things like that. And they're never like these huge murders you hear about on the news. It was often like between families and things like that. Some really awful ones. So I never worry about those things not happening in real life. Sadly, they do. But I also asked my sister, who still works in the police, and she's got very good at just responding to my texts really politely. If I'm just like, how would I do this? And she just doesn't even ask anymore if it's for a book. I think for this one, she actually got, I think it was a detective, to check some details for me, which I was expecting for it to take a while. I emailed her while she was working a night shift, and she was like, oh, I'll go and ask someone. And she had an answer back within like an hour.
So that's quite amazing. Yeah, like your own consultancy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are your pieces of advice, so, for anyone that is looking at starting to write something in this genre?
So definitely read in the genre. I think that sounds silly, but a lot of some YouTube people are like, oh, don't really ever read thrillers. I think you've got to read widely, especially things that are coming out new, but also kind of the like big names in the genre, and kind of the indie stuff as well is really helpful. I would be amiss not to say, seeing as me and Joanna both get some of our income from them, but Jericho Writers is a great place to get kind of help and support. There's loads of free stuff. We have previously had a lot of thriller authors on the staff, which means some of our things are slightly more skewed to thrillers. So we have lots of free blog posts. Anna herself runs a lot of amazing events with lots of great thriller authors. But just start writing. Like, I had no idea what I was doing when I started, like absolutely no idea at all. And it turned out all right. So I think getting over that fear, sometimes you just need someone. Like, my husband was the person who said to me, like, oh, I think you'll write a book one day. And it went from this thing of other people write books and I can't imagine how, to like, oh, maybe I could write a book. And it turned out I could. So I think sometimes you just need to hear that. And you can tell that to yourself. You don't need to wait for someone to tell you.
Yes, or we don't all need to marry Tom.
No, he's unavailable, unfortunately.
Although, I mean, I'd be very, you could do a lot worse. What have you learned, Soph, since you've become a published author in the last 3 years, about the publishing industry? Because it's a funny one thing.
It's funny. I think it's never going to make you a millionaire unless you're one of very few people. But I try and see it more as like, what else does it bring to my life? And if I was doing it purely for monetary reasons, I probably wouldn't still be here. But like the job I have at Jericho, like, you are a friend, and lots of friends I've made, I'd never meet them in real life. It's really like broadened my horizons massively from what my life was like before to after. So there's that. But I think not to get too discouraged as well. Like, people can say like, oh, you never make your money, never do this. But it depends what you want to do it for. Like, I think people should definitely be paid more. Like, I'm not saying that, but I don't think if you go into it with that idea that it's going to make you a lot of money, you're ever going to feel particularly fulfilled. But there's lots of like really pleasant things it brings to your life, other than a bank balance, which most of us know it doesn't really bring that.
What's next for you, Soph? What's your next project?
So I'm working on a book at the moment. I'm not very far into it, but I'll be able to say a bit more news about it soon. But it's about a hen do. I am obsessed with hen do's. I've been on so many hen do's. So it's two old best friends who have their hen do's combined by their other friends last minute as a surprise, and their friends don't actually know that they've not spoken for a long time, and they're kind of suddenly forced in this house together over the weekend.
I am obsessed. That sounds amazing. How can we find and follow you, Soph, and get our hands on a copy of If They Knew?
I have a website, which is not great, but it's okay. It's sophieflynn.com. I'm very active on Twitter, which is probably the best place to get me, and very active on Facebook and semi-active on Instagram, but it's usually Sophie Flynn author. I think on Twitter I'm at Sophie L. Flynn.
Thank you for joining us, Sophie, and thank you very much for being this month's book club book.
Oh, thank you for choosing me. It's lovely to chat to you.
One of my favourite times of year in Brighton is May, because I absolutely love the Brighton Fringe, and I have been speaking to their wonderful programmers and looking at all the great literary events that we have got going on this year in Brighton. So Brighton Fringe returns to the city from the 5th of May to the 4th of June this year. Over 100 venues are taking part, from the Wagner Hall in the city centre to Patcham's Memorial Hall to the Poets Pub in Hove, and even as far afield field as the Houseboat Verda in Shoreham-by-Sea. Brighton Fringe plays host to comedy, cabaret, theatre, dance and circus, alongside a programme of literature and spoken word. This year's highlights of the literature and spoken word programme include the return of Hammer and Tongue on the 29th of May at Brighton's Open Air Theatre. Hammer and Tongue is a nationwide family of slam poets and spoken word artists, and for the second year running, Hammer and Tongue bring their regional final of their infamous slam poetry contest to Brighton Fringe. Also taking place this May, adapted from a Chilean children's book, Persilis Theatre Company performs family-friendly The Seagull and the Cat at Pop-Up Theatre The Rotunda in Regency Square on the 29th of May. With original music and songs, the award-winning Persilis Theatre Company bring this heartfelt story to life with their special mix of accessibility, diversity and rough theatre. You also shouldn't miss what I'm sure is to be a standout event of the Fringe, Mythos Ragnarok, taking place from the 23rd of May till the 3rd of June. This is an epic dark comedy combining Norse mythology, storytelling and full contact wrestling. Sounds absolutely mad. Join Odin and Loki in their struggle to overcome primeval giants, rival gods and goddesses and each other's ambitions. Playing host to Mythos is a new pop-up outdoor festival site that will be hosting fringe events all month long, called Caravanserai. Situated north of St Peter's Church, Caravanserai is less than a 10-minute walk from Brighton Station. It is built out of repurposed caravans with vintage fairground waltzes, where hoopla stalls and shootout galleries become bars. The site will be free to enter, with street food stalls to enjoy, a dedicated family area for children, secret spots to be discovered, and a Brighton Fringe box office on site. Tickets for Brighton Fringe are on sale now via their website, brightonfringe.org, with hundreds of events to choose from. There is something here to capture everybody's imagination. And thank you for listening to the Brighton Book Club. Our next book club book is Dazzling by Sussex-based Chikodili Elemumadu. If you like the show, you can catch up on previous episodes from over the last 3 years on all good podcast platforms. If you have a book out or an idea for the show, email btnbookclub@gmail.com and follow us over on Instagram @btnbookclub. We will see you next month.